Well, what a surprise. I've got some friends from Israel that happen to be passing through. We've pulled them into the studio. We're going to go from the Holocaust to the land of Israel to teen life in Israel today. Stay tuned.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
One of the neat things about live radio is that you can change direction on a dime. And last night I got confirmation that some dear friends from Israel were going to be driving through the area and would be able to stop and spend some time with us today on The Line of Fire. Tell us their story, which is a story you definitely want to hear. And we'll also talk about life in the land. We'll get some different perspectives. We may even get a teen perspective from Israel if things go well. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. If you want a perspective from within the land of Israel, an honest perspective about what God's doing among the Jewish people, perspective about some of the political issues, we'll talk about that, but we really want to put our focus on the spiritual end of things. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.com. org. If you go to our Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, we've got contact info for our guests, whom I will now introduce, Michael and Orit Murnane from Israel. Great to have you on The Line of Fire today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
To be here.
All right, Michael, you got to get closer to that mic, buddy. I know you're mild-mannered.
Okay.
All right. We are, with the encouragement of you, Michael, we're going to focus a lot of the interview today on Orit and her family history and from Holocaust to the land of Israel, some remarkable things. But before we do that, Michael, you're not born in Israel.
No, I was not.
Where were you born?
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts.
We've got folks listening on WEZE in Boston right now. Okay, how in the world did you, as a man from Boston, end up in Israel and then marrying a native-born Israeli?
Well, in short, I was on a spiritual journey of really seeking the Lord. I grew up in the church. And I grew up in actually a Jewish community there, and quite a few of my Jewish friends started coming to Jesus as the Messiah.
And what's your own background, Jewish, Gentile?
Gentile. Actually grew up in the Catholic Church.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
So a Boston guy.
Boston guy, yes.
Oh,
guy,
not guy.
Boy. Yeah, right.
All right.
Yes.
So you grow up in church, some of your Jewish friends start getting saved.
And from there, we started forming a little community together, and with that, we saw that something was in Israel there that we wanted to find out. We wanted to go deep into our spiritual roots and find out
what
whole thing came from.
Hang on. You are a Catholic boy from Boston. Now you're saved. Why are you thinking you've got any kind of roots in Israel?
Well, I'm reading the Bible, and everything's about Israel. Jesus born in Israel, Bethlehem, he's coming back to Israel, the Mount of Olives. And I'm saying, well, this is Boston, but the whole Bible's talking about Israel from front to end. And I didn't really quite understand that. So I had to really go on this journey to figure out what this whole thing was.
So how did you end up living there, moving there?
Well, after seeking the Lord quite a bit of time, I really had a dream one night where the Lord really spoke to me in an internal audible voice. And I don't say that too easily. And he just simply said to me, I want you to live in Israel forever.
Mm.
That was very overwhelming. I was young. I was in my early 20s. And I just simply, at that point, put a backpack on and went over to Israel, and the Lord from there just opened many doors and kind of grew up there in my second portion of life.
All right, so you've been in the States for one little stretch, and then you'll visit the States, but otherwise, how long have you lived in Israel now?
I moved to Israel in 79.
1979.
Yeah, 79.
Wow.
And it's been a wonderful journey since then. And I actually found my place there.
And how long have you and Orit been married?
We've been married 25 years this year. In June.
And how many kids?
We have six children.
Six kids.
Older children and six younger children.
Yeah. Well, three and three.
Three and three.
Three and three. So your oldest is how old?
She's 23.
Your youngest is how old?
And my youngest is 9.
All right. You told me through email that Orit had quite a story beyond what I've even known. Chatting before the show, it's amazing. So Orit, we come to your story, and we'll start at the Holocaust when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is great to be with you. It's Thursday, which means we are focused on Israel and the Jewish people. And we've got some guests from Israel with us. I couldn't announce it too much in advance because we were finalizing last night if they were able, able to drive in, meet us in time to be on the air. But I'm delighted to welcome Michael and Orit Murnane to the studio with me. Now, by the way, I am also Michael. It's Michael in English. If you ever wonder why Michael is spelled, it's a strange spelling, M-I-C-H-A-E-L. It's because it's Hebrew, Michael, who is like God. So Michael and Michael. And Michael's wife, Orit Murnane. Now, Orit, we agreed, Michael agreed, that we wanted to focus on your story, native-born Israeli, but quite an extraordinary story. I've known you for years, but I didn't know a lot of these details. So let's go all the way back to the Holocaust, to what happened to your grandparents, and then we'll talk about how God was at work even in the midst of this terrible disaster. But where are your grandparents from, and what happened with them at the time of the Holocaust?
My grandparents are both from Russia and Romania. My grandmother was from Russia, and my grandfather from Romania. And they met in Romania, and they had a little child, and the war started. They lived in a very remote, small village. And
so this is late 1930s or early 1940s?
Late 30s, early, beginning of 40s, right.
Okay.
And the war have already started. My grandmother was at work at that time, and my grandfather was at home working. Suddenly, the Nazis broke through the door, opened the door. The door flung open. They walked in, grabbed my grandfather by the arms, and literally dragged him outside and threw him on a truck with a whole bunch of Jewish men from the village.
So they were just looking for Jews in this remote area of Romania, and they found your father.
That's right. The only reason they didn't take my grandmother is because she was at work at that time, and they couldn't find her. Now, what they didn't see is when the door flung open, it hid behind a bassinet with a 3-month-old sleeping baby. Mm. Now, the fact that the baby was asleep when the Nazis walked in have saved the baby's life, because if she would have cried, they would have shot her right on the spot. And that have saved the baby's life. And
just because she was a Jew.
They would have killed
the baby because it's a Jewish baby.
And she would have cried, and so she would have been an interference, and they would have shot her. And that baby was my mother.
Mm.
So the Lord has spared my mother's life the
Amazing.
First time out of many, many times after. Now, when the neighbors saw what happened, they ran quickly to my grandmother's workplace and they called her. From that minute on, she took the baby and she went into hiding. So the lady that she worked for as a housekeeper said that she'll hide her and give her shelter and food in exchange for work. So they have spent the next 4 years in the basement. My mother says it was literally like a solitary confinement. No windows, no fresh air, no light, fresh light from outside. Barely any food, because it was during the war. There was no food, no proper clothing, no heating in the basement, and they could not go out for 4 years.
So this is not they'd go out a few times a day to get some fresh air. You're saying she couldn't go out?
No, except just one time that she went out for 10 minutes to see the snow and breathe some fresh air. She did not see the outside for 4 years. It was literally like being buried in a solitary confinement cell.
Oh, my.
All the way till the war was over. Now, having 6 children of myself, I cannot imagine what it's like to raise a child in a basement and having to keep the child in hush, not making any noise, not laughing, not jumping or running for 4 years. I cannot imagine what kind of a life my mother and my grandmother had.
Mm.
And during this whole time, they didn't know if my grandfather, Eliyahu, was he alive or dead. There was no news about him at all.
And so where was he ultimately taken?
So he was taken to a number of concentration camps where he had endured not just the concentration camp, but also medical, physical experiments. He had endured and survived them all. Now, at the end of the war...
All right, so just some listeners may not be familiar with how monstrous the Nazis were. So they were always looking to experiment, to see how people responded to certain things, or what they could do to create a super race, or whatever
right.
ideas they had, or just to torment right. and torture people.
Right.
So they had, you know, they especially were fascinated with twins and the right. twins went through unbelievable, horrific things.
Right, they were used like guinea pigs, basically, like lab guinea pigs for all kinds of medical experiments.
And sometimes no anesthesia or anything like that.
That's
just
right.
Most
of the time, no anesthesia because they didn't care for these people. They just wanted to get the results.
So your grandfather had experiments performed on him.
Right, but he never talked about it because it was way too traumatic for him.
Yeah.
Now, the last place he was taken right before the war ended was a labor camp where all the prisoners that have lasted, who didn't die during the Holocaust in the concentration camp, were taken to the labor camp in hopes that they will die then. So they made them work very hard in physical manual labor with stones and things like that, barely any food, very harsh conditions. And they also did experiments of them. And one of the experiments was to give the prisoners poisoned peas to see whether they'll die or live. And what happened is most of them did not die, but it affected their legs, and most of them came almost paralyzed out of the Holocaust, out of that camp. And so I remember my grandfather almost at the end of his life walking very hardly with a cane. It affected his legs, and not only his legs, he came out of the Holocaust as an abusive man, mentally, emotionally, and physically an abusive man because of all the traumatic stuff that he had endured. My mother recalls that the Holocaust continued in their home ever since after. It was the effect of the Holocaust ever since after.
Remarkable. Yeah. How could someone not be traumatized? And the hell that he lived through obviously is completely unimaginable. So your mother survives the Holocaust, basically hostage in a basement. That's the what's provided for 4 years, basically solitary confinement with your grandmother raising your mother as a little baby. Your grandfather survives torture, mm-hmm. medical experimentation, slave labor, and all of this. So now they're still, though, in Europe. How did they get over to Israel?
So after the war, they got reunited. And just like a lot of Jews, many Jews right after the Holocaust, right out of the concentration camp, they aborted boats and were headed towards Israel. Now, Israel was under the British mandate at that time, and when the British people started to see that many, like hundreds and thousands of Jewish people are trying to come back to Israel, they were not too happy about it. So they would turn the ships around. Now, this is what happened to my grandparents. They signed up on a ship, they aborted the ship, and something happened the last minute. They decided to get off the ship and sign on the next one.
All right, so they got on the ship.
Right.
They boarded that ship. That ship is heading to Israel. And they decide last minute, for some reason, to get off that ship, get on the next one.
Right. Now, what happened is that first ship got blown in mid-ocean. It got sunk in mid-ocean by the British people. The British people have blown some of the boats that were heading towards Israel because they didn't want the Jewish people to reach the shores.
All right. You're not making this up. This is not just some anti-British myth or some Jewish story. This actually happened, that the ships coming in were not being welcomed by the British, and they were actually shot
right.
down. They were sunk
right.
at sea.
Right, and most of them were averted and sent to Cyprus, where the British people built a refugee camp, where they would catch all the boats coming in, pretty much like the cats catching the mouse,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to come into Israel, and they would turn them and send them to Cyprus, and so a lot of Jews, thousands of Jews, have spent months and months in tents, in temporary conditions, in harsh conditions, in a refugee camp in Cyprus until it was decided what should be done with them.
All right, we've got just about a minute before the break, and this is a story that must be told and that many listeners are still just unaware of, and all we can do is just touch some of the reality of what happened with the Holocaust. But just in this next minute, Ori, why Israel? I mean, it's not like they were always thinking we want to live in Israel one day. Why were they now turning to Israel? Was it the only option for them?
Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, if you look at the Bible, the Lord is talking, the Lord is giving prophecies after prophecies through the minor and major prophets that he's going to regather all the Jewish people from all the four corners of the earth and bring them back to Israel. Now, You know, have you ever thought of how, practically, how does the Lord fulfill a prophecy in the semi-modern world of the 20th century? How does he gather all these people from all around the world practically? You know, does he send an SMS message to everybody? I'm moving right now to Israel. Does he send a Facebook message, you know, an event message invitation? How does he do that? You know, how do people get together from all over the world? Well, after the Holocaust, you know, they came out, the Jewish people came out like ashes from the fire, basically. The Lord has engraved this desire deep in their hearts to one day go back to Israel. You know, the Jewish people always say, next year in Jerusalem.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to talk about that next year in Jerusalem. Hey, how does God cause his prophetic word to come to pass? Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, this Thursday on the Line of Fire as we focus on Israel, the Jewish people, Israel-related issues. Some weeks we'll answer objections from the rabbis to the Messiahship of Jesus. Some weeks we'll look at Messianic prophecy. Some weeks we'll look at what's happening in the land of Israel today or answer Jewish-related questions. Today, it's my joy to have in the studio with me Michael and Orit Murnain, living in Israel many years now. Orit, a native-born Israeli believer. She's been telling her story and her grandparents' miraculous preservation through the Holocaust and how God brought them back to the land of Israel. We'll pick up on that in one moment, Orit. But Michael, as you're in the States with your family now, just give our listeners an idea of what you and Orit do in ministry, what the burden of your heart is.
Well, while we've been here in the States, we've been traveling around to many different churches and sharing the word of God about Israel and God's end times plan that includes Israel and the church. So we've seen quite an awakening over the last year, 2 years, etc., of pastors really wanting to know this because, like me, they probably saw that in the Word was everything's about Israel, and they wanted to understand that. So we're teaching different weekend seminars and sharing God's Word of to stand with Israel and understanding from a biblical perspective of what Paul said in Romans 9, 10, and 11, that the irrevocable call of Israel. So we're sharing that as we're going along in these days.
All right, friends, if you've got a question you'd like to ask Michael and Orit, as always when I do an interview, I kind of hog the time because a lot of questions I want to ask, a lot I want to find out from our guests. But if you've got a question, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. And your website, if folks want to contact you,
it is iblessjerusalem.com.
So one word, iblessjerusalem.com. If they want to email you or be in contact with you about having you come to their church or congregation,
they could write to a personal email at cometozion@aol.com.
All right, cometozion@aol.com. Right, we'll chat more, Michael.
Okay, Michael.
But again, by our agreement, we're focusing on the amazing story that your wife, Orit, has. So your grandparents now survived the Holocaust. They're coming over now with your mother, who's still a little girl, miraculously preserved as well. They're the first boat that they're going to take. They end up getting off the boat for just unknown reasons. They decide to get off the boat, get on the next one. That boat gets sunk at sea by the British.
That's right.
They come in on the next boat. What was their experience actually coming to the land of Israel?
Well, my mother recalls that when they finally allowed them to go to Israel, it was basically because of humanitarian reasons, because the people at the camp, at the refugee camp, started to get very ill, especially
in Cyprus,
especially the elderly and the young children. And by that time, her parents had another baby, a son, whom they, of course, named Israel. And so they allowed, out of humanitarian reasons, for this group of people to move to Israel first. The year was 47, November of 47. So my mother recalls them, all these hundreds and hundreds of people sitting on the deck of a boat. It was not a cruise ship by any means. It was just like an old boat that they were put on. A very cold November night. The waves were very, very high. People were getting very sick on the way to Israel. It was basically an overnight trip. And disease were high. People were throwing up, being very, very sick. But at 6 o'clock in the morning, they arrived the shores of Israel. They arrived Haifa, and the sun was just coming up Mount Carmel, and all the people were standing up on their feet in a complete hush. She said there was a holy hush, holy silence, as people were looking at the nation of Israel, the land of Israel, the mountains of Israel, the first time after 2,000 years. And after this holy hush, they all started to sing together Hatikva, which is Israel's national anthem that talks about how the Jewish people always long, look towards Zion, long to be free in their own nation. And here is their passion and their desire of thousands of years is coming true right at that moment.
And were your grandparents religious people at all?
Not at all. And I'm thinking maybe my grandfather even maybe have lost his faith in God for a while because of all the hardship that he had gone through. A lot of people have lost their faith in God. You know, people intend to romanticize, you know, that the Jewish people go back to land, fulfill the promise, fulfill the prophetic word, and they think, you know, did God speak to them? You know, did the Holy Spirit speak to them? It was literally practical. You know, it was more practical than you think. Yes, God moved them all. God moved them all. But the prophecy was fulfilled by Jewish people not filled with the Holy Spirit as we understand it, not hearing the Holy Spirit speaking to them audibly. A lot of them were atheists because of what they have gone through, but they understood that this is their only place. This is the land given to them by God, and He had engraved it in their hearts. Just as we said before, the Jewish people always say next year in Jerusalem, and they've said that for generations. What is it based on? They are basing that on biblical prophecies that one day will be in Jerusalem. It's just not a saying, you know, to say one day we'll be in Jerusalem.
So somehow this was even in the hearts of people that were not even religious. And when they realized they had to flee, they had no homeland, they had no place where they were welcome, they had lost everything.
Right.
The unthinkable had happened.
Right.
Because there had been pogroms in Eastern Europe and massacres of Jews, but nothing on this level.
Right.
So somehow in the midst of this living hell, God works to bring the Jewish people back to the land. All right. Any folks that are going to be leaving us, we've got an amazing story that continues in terms of the birth of the first Messianic congregation and Jewish believers in Israel, and then how God began to stir up the remnant. So if you're not going to get to hear the rest of the broadcast, go to askdrbrown.org, click on the Line of Fire. You can listen on internet, or later today you can catch the entire broadcast. And we're going to keep going into the second hour as well and talk about a whole lot of other things. Reverend Bruce, hang on. You've got a good question I want to put to our guests as well. Hey, friends, just a reminder that as you stand with us here on the Line of Fire, if you're a torchbearer, if you're one of our growing army of supporters, you're helping us every day reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel. You're helping us every day equip the body. You're helping us every day strengthen Jewish believers in their faith and their walk with the Lord. So we appreciate your help. We appreciate you standing with us. And we've got a wonderful resource offer. Many of you have taken advantage of already this week, but just want to remind you, two of the best teaching series we've ever done, over 20 hours of teaching, 10-plus hours on how to be led by the Spirit. In fact, I believe, Michael and Ari, you were in this class when I taught it years ago on how to be led by the Spirit. 10-plus hours, practical, clear, edifying, and then 10-plus hours on how to live a holy life, how to walk in the grace of God, how to overcome condemnation, what holiness means. They're only $20 for each CD, but you can get both CDs. So over 20 hours of teaching on two CDs for your computer or MP3 player for $20, and we'll pay the postage on top of it. So give us a call, 1-800-278-9978. Hey, I'm Jewish, and it's still a very good offer. 1-800-278-9978, or if you want to stand with us with a one-time gift or help us in our outreach to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Number to call, 1-800-278-9978. But by all means, take advantage of this offer, and by all means, pray for the salvation of Israel. Pray for the salvation of the Muslim world. Pray that Jesus, Yeshua, will be mightily glorified in the Middle East. Lord, your kingdom come, your will be done.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you, serving as a voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. And friends, if we are going to get in harmony with God's plans, God's purposes, and be world changers, we better understand what God is doing in Israel. I've got special guests with me from Israel, but in the States, and able to work it out driving from Virginia on your way to...
To Florida.
All right, stop by to see us here in Charlotte, North Carolina. 866-34-TRUTH if you have a question for our guests online. Ask drbrown.org. All right, there's a whole lot more I want to talk to you about, Orit. Quite an amazing narrative of what happens in Israel. But first, let's go to the phones, grab a question from Reverend Bruce in Suffolk County. Where in Suffolk County, Long Island?
I don't want to give that much of a detail.
Okay, you don't have to. That's fine. Somewhere in little Suffolk County. All right, somewhere between.
I'll give you a hint. It's where the horror house is.
Oh, okay. Just starts with an A and ends with an E. Sounds good.
Okay.
Sure. What's your question?
Well, I'm curious as to get their take. I have my own opinion, but I want to hear from them or you. Your take on the 11 tribes coming back into Israel, and then plus, of course, Judah. Because we now know that they're discovering tribes all over the world. We have some from in North India. We, of course, we know about the ones from Ethiopia. Where do you think these tribes are, and how do you think this, you know, I just want your take on all the tribes returning and where they're coming from.
You got it.
Yeah. Answer that.
great question. And by the way, there's a remnant of the tribe of Dan in Amityville. No, I'm just kidding.
What about Simeon? What about Shimon? You know what
I'm glad you laughed after that question. All right, Michael and Arita are looking at me for me to take this one. So, in short, you have a few things that happen. First, with the destruction of the Northern Kingdom in 721. You had some of those from the north moving down to the south. You have Hezekiah inviting them down. You have Josiah inviting them down. So you definitely had many from the north coming down into the south that would then mingle with Judah, Benjamin, so that among the kingdom of Judah, you had probably all 12 tribes represented, while the bulk of the northern tribes got scattered. Some of them have been completely lost to history. But we know in James, Jacob, the first chapter, he writes to the 12 tribes, to Jewish believers. So they represent all the 12 tribes. So it would seem, on the first level, that among the Jewish people today, there is a representation of all the 12 tribes. And yet, there's definitely a scattering, for the most part, of the 10 northern tribes. Some of the people seem to be completely lost to history. And then there are others that they are finding pockets, like you said, in India or Ethiopia. Some will dispute whether they go back to the tribes of Israel, and there's DNA tests, you know, arguing about that. And others, you know, within Israel, you have rabbis that are constantly going out around the world looking for these remnants. So to me, you've got scattered remnants here and there that God's regathering. And okay, Arit, go ahead.
I just want to say that even us, the Israelis, we don't know which tribe we came from, okay? So to claim that other people know where we've been scattered and where we are, you know, scattered around the world, it's a little over-presumptuous, I would think. Because even we don't know ourselves which tribes we are unless you carry the name of Cohen and Levi. That's a definite, because also many Jewish people have changed their last names, although they know that they're Jewish, but for sure they had to change their last Jewish name because of persecution in the past in history.
Right. So it's the idea that we're definitely finding all these remnants of tribes around the world. It is questionable, but there seem to be some remnants that God continues to restore. Great question. Thanks for asking it. Back to Arit's story. The amazing history of the beginning of the Messianic Jewish movement in the land of Israel.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I've had the privilege of ministering in the land of Israel a good number of times. I've got many, many friends living in Israel, Jewish believers that are on the front lines of Messianic ministry there. I've watched things grow since I first went to Israel to minister in 1986. But there's a history that goes way back before then that's really amazing in terms of what God is doing in the land of Israel. My guest in the studio with me today, Michael and Orit Murnane, they live in Israel, but they're here in the States with some of their family, their younger part of their family, for an extended trip, and were able to join me. And if you missed the first part of the show and going back to the Holocaust and how Orit's grandparents miraculously made it through the Holocaust, make sure you go to our website, askdrbrown.org, click on the Line of Fire to listen. And again, if you've got a question for our guests, although I'm not going to take a lot of calls, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Okay, Orit, you've talked about the prophecies in the Bible about God restoring the Jewish people to the land. Now, some of them clearly began to be fulfilled when our people came back to Babylon 2,500 years ago, but that was only a beginning. We've remained scattered, and most of the words spoken didn't happen. Many people say, if it is a real fulfillment of prophecy, then the Jewish people have to repent first, and when they repent, God would bring them back to the land. Ezekiel 36, though, says something very different. So before we talk about the specifics of what God began to do in the 1950s, explain this order where God says, I'll bring you back. I mean, you're still in sin. It's not because of your righteousness, but my name's being defiled. I'll bring you back, and then I'll sprinkle clean water upon you in the land. Tell me what that means.
Right, we need to look at Ezekiel 37 and 36. You know, when God gives a prophecy, you know, it may take, also when we get a prophecy, we know it may take 20, 30 years before it's been fulfilled. But once it's been fulfilled, we're expecting it to happen right away, you know, within a month or a few weeks. But not so with the word of God. It may take a generation or two generations to be fulfilled. So starting with Ezekiel 37, with the vision of the dry bones, the Lord says, I will bring them back to the land. I will raise them up. I will give them my spirit. I will give them a life. I will restore their land. I will take them out of their graves and bring them to the land of Israel. And then I will give them my spirit, which goes back to Ezekiel 36. So the first part of the prophecy has been fulfilled, and it's been taken a generation and still is, that the land of Israel, from all the way from nothing back in the 40s, okay, almost nothing, to have a state that is fully established, great on technology and high tech and agriculture and everything, you know, very modern state, but it's just physical. The physical Israel.
Yes.
What about the spiritual Israel? God speaks in Ezekiel 36 about the spiritual part that is still not fully being fulfilled. We are still living in the middle of prophecy. We're seeing prophecy being fulfilled in front of our eyes right now. Starting with the body of Messiah that God started to raise in Israel back in the 50s.
All right, so how did this happen? And this ties in, amazingly, directly with your own family.
That's right. It's like we've been pioneers from the very, very beginning, even from the time of our grandparents coming to Israel. That is pioneering, and we're still pioneering in the land today. So when my grandparents came to Israel, there were basically no Messianic believers, hardly at all, maybe one family, just to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Now there were Jewish Christians in Germany. That's how they would have been identified, or Jewish believers in the church. They didn't call themselves Messianic Jews, but they got killed in the Holocaust like other Jews did.
Right.
So the fact that you were part of a church, as long as you had Jewish blood, the Nazis were going to get you and kill you. And there were even some churches that turned the Jews over as well.
That's
so
right.
At the time now that you have Jews coming back from the Holocaust, resettling
right.
in the land of Israel, you didn't have a lot of Jewish believers, you're not even aware of any.
No, I want to give you a little history so you can appreciate what God has done just in one generation in Israel. And we're going to look back to the early 50s when there were about four congregations only in the land of Israel, one in Haifa, one in Jerusalem, one in Tel Aviv, Jaffa, and one in Beersheba. All of them were established by missionaries, Church of the Brethren, the Lutheran Church, by missionaries who were not Jewish people, who started these little churches, not even Messianic congregations. The preaching was done in a foreign language, in Russian, in British, English. They were singing British hymns, not in Hebrew, not worship Hebrew. The people who came to the church were mostly foreigners, and just a handful of maybe Jewish believers, elderly, maybe from the Holocaust, who survived the Holocaust. Every congregation must have had not more than 20, 30 people. That was it. That was it. And God forbid that they should express their faith to the others, because back then it was absolutely unacceptable for a Jewish believer to believe in Yeshua. You would have been considered to be the greatest traitor of your heritage, because your forefathers have died to stay Jewish throughout the history.
And was there a connection in the minds of those European Jews that the Holocaust was connected to Christianity in any way?
The understanding is that the Jews are killed in the Holocaust by the Nazis, who are looked upon as Catholics. That's all the Jewish people know, that all Christians are Catholics. They don't understand that there are dominations, spirit-filled, not spirit-filled. For them, they put all Christians in one bucket, and they're all Catholics. For them, Catholics are idol worshippers, because what Jewish people know about Catholics is that they worship the statue, kiss the statue of Mary, the feet of the statue of Mary, and bow down to the statue of Jesus, and have all these little saints there. So for them, Jesus is an idol, and therefore Catholics are idol worshippers. Therefore, the Nazis, who are Catholics, have killed the Jews because of Jesus.
Right, and look, there were people that went into concentration camps. You know, we have the testimonies of some of them, and there on the gates it's inscribed, you know, because you killed our God, we'll kill you.
Yes.
So to now say I'm a Jew and I'm following Jesus right after the Holocaust would have been unthinkable.
Unthinkable completely.
All right, so how does your grandfather tie in with the story?
Okay, so one day after my grandparents have settled down in Haifa, he opened a little store of electric appliances where he would fix stuff, and a man walked in his store, and he had a list of names on a piece of paper, and he asked my father whether he knew these people or not. So my grandfather looked at the list and he said, "No, I don't know any of these people. I'm willing to help you find them, but can you tell me why are you looking for them?" The story was that this man was a Norwegian missionary living in Romania. So when he came to my grandfather's store, he could speak Romanian to him.
Mm.
Now you have to understand that back then people came from all kinds of countries, so it was basically like Babylon. Different languages, not too much communication between the people. Everybody was trying to learn Hebrew at that point. So my grandfather said, "Well, what are you looking for?" And he said, "Well," he explained, "I'm a Norwegian missionary. I lived in Romania," and he was the colleague of Richard Wurmbrand, that I'm sure many of the people listening know who he is. He is a pastor living in Romania who had many churches. He was 14 years in a solitary confinement for his faith in Yeshua, in Jesus. The Soviet regime put him in solitary confinement.
Yeah, horrific suffering, 14 years imprisonment, over two imprisonments, years in solitary confinement. So he was a colleague of
Wurmbrand. So they were colleagues, and they had a few churches. They pastored those churches. Now, in their churches, they had a few Jewish people. When the war started, their churches have dispersed, and they had no people and no churches at that time during the war. After the war was over, that pastor, just like the good shepherd, he says, "Well, where are my Jewish people?" He was looking for his Jewish people, and he said, "Surely they have gone to Israel." So he aborted the ship. He left his wife and children in Norway, went on a ship and went to Haifa, the first port, and walked downtown Haifa with a list looking for his lost sheep, you know. And so my grandfather, you know, was a good-hearted man, and he said, "I don't know any of the people, but I'll go and look with you." So they've been wandering downtown Haifa, and long before they knew it, they found people. And this is how the first congregation of Haifa, or maybe the second one, I forget, started, with the help of a non-believer. You know, God has a sense of humor how he uses people.
So a Norwegian pastor with a love for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, working in Romania, goes to Israel to look for his lost sheep that survived, and gets the help of a non-believing Jewish man that happens to be your grandfather, and that ends up helping to plant a congregation.
Which is still there till today. It's called Beit Eliyahu, not after my grandfather Eliyahu, but after Elijah the prophet, because it's in Mount Carmel, and it's still there till this very day.
Amazing. And just to jump ahead, from 1950, right, until today, as far as believers within the land in 1950, thereabouts, you're saying it's a handful.
Right, right.
Okay, how about how many people who were born in Israel? Let's go forward 20, 30 years, say 1975.
Right. All the way from the early 50s till about the late 70s, 78, 79, there were hardly no believers coming to the Lord at all because of persecution and because it was totally unacceptable.
And especially if you're a native-born Israeli, hardly any.
None.
All right, and things have changed dramatically. We'll pick that up. We come back. Friends, God is at work. This is not hype. This is reality. God is at work among the Jewish people in the land of Israel.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We're going to do something in a little while. During the break, I talked to Michal and Arit, and we agreed to do something where we will put our voices together in a little while. No, we're not going to sing. We're going to do something better. We're going to do something as a prophetic act of what's going to happen with our Jewish people around the world in the future, and we hope in the near future, and it's very scriptural, but we're going to do something together in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Michael Brown, delighted to have you with us today, and our special guests, Michal and Arit Murnane. Those of you that are really interested in this, as we talk about Israel, just amazing stories, we're getting teared up as we share some of these together. I'm going to take the next hour interviewing their family. We're going to talk to their teenage daughter, Oriah, who's here, and just find out what life is like for teenagers, what happens in schools with war and bomb threats and things like that. So, again, I invite you to get our second hour by going online, askdrbrown.org, click on the Line of Fire. Keep listening to the great programming on your station here, and then later tonight when you get a chance to catch up on things, listen to the second hour. Okay, Arit.
Yes.
Notice I haven't given the phone number out again because I'm just going to talk to Arit without taking any calls this last segment here. Okay, in Ezekiel, there are prophecies about God taking out the stony heart and putting in a heart of flesh.
Right.
And Paul talks about, in 2 Corinthians, the third chapter, the veil being lifted.
Right.
There are many Christians who love Israel, and they pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and they pray for peace in the Middle East. And that's good, and it's biblical. We know that ultimately lasting peace will only come in the Middle East when Yeshua returns.
That's right.
And rules and reigns. We do what we can towards peace, but we know ultimately that's the only thing that can happen. But it's easy to think of these things abstract,
that's right,
generalized. But you literally experienced the reality of this God taking out a stony heart, putting
right
in a heart of flesh. So tell us what happened in your own life.
Okay. Well, I came to the Lord when I was 17, and I came to the Lord by a Christian, a non-Jew, a Dutch man, who basically just shared with us the message, you know, just his life story, how he came to the Lord. Nothing in his story pertained to me or had to do with me, but when I heard it, the Lord literally broke my heart, and I felt like my heart of stone is being broken in two and being physically replaced with a heart of flesh. I physically felt it. At the same time, I felt that I had a veil in front of my eyes, and the veil had been removed instantly. And I was so shocked that I said to myself, wow, I feel like I was blind, and now I can see. And I'm not even knowing that there is a scripture that talks about that. So all I want to say, friends, is that the veil in front of the Jewish people's eyes is not a narrative, is not a symbolic thing. You know, it's not a spiritual thing, although it is. Also, is the heart of stone is not a narrative or symbolic. It's not super spiritual, but it's a spiritual thing and a physical thing. So I would like to encourage you that when you pray for Israel, when you pray for the Jewish people to come to the saving knowledge of Yeshua, pray specifically for the veil to be removed and for the heart to be to get a heart of flesh, because as I said, it's very physical, and a lot of Jewish people do experience it. It's a fulfillment of prophecy. It says that the Jewish people are not going to see Yeshua until they all say,
Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Let's say it again. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai.
Which means blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
It's a way of welcoming back the Messiah. So Michael, why is it important for the church to be praying for the Jewish people to be saved? We want to see everybody saved. We want to see the gospel go to the whole world. Many of my Messianic Jewish friends in Israel are actively working with Arabs and reaching out to Palestinians. I just got a prayer request for a Messianic Jewish youth conference taking place, and they're doing a lot outreach to the Palestinian kids and the believers and trying to work together. We want to see everyone come to faith, and yet there's a special importance for the church to pray for the Jewish people. Why is that, Michael?
Jesus said at the end of Matthew that, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I long to gather you under my wings, but you are not willing. And then he said the profound thing, you will not see me until you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Scholars agree broad scale that the Yeshua said he was not coming back until the Jewish people would also welcome him back, because it's his original plan to bring the Jewish people into the kingdom of God and save them. The new covenant in Ezekiel and Jeremiah clearly shows in the last days they will come to the Lord. Zechariah 12:10, they'll look upon the one they've pierced and receive him. And then in chapter 14, then he puts his foot on the Mount of Olives. So it's in God's plan to redeem the Jewish people in the end. So he desires that they would, he promised that he would include them, to the remnant of them. So it's important that he said he will not come back until they say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai.
Yeah, so, you know, it reminds me of when David had to flee for his life before Absalom, and Absalom took over the kingdom, and then Absalom was killed in battle. And then the tribes began to say, you know, David's our king. I mean, we should have him back. And they began to write to him and said, David, come back. And he wrote to the elders of Judah. He said, you're my flesh and blood. Why should you be the last to welcome the king back? You know, so there is something about Messiah's own people have to welcome him back. So God's heart beats for the entire world. The way he set things up, ultimately salvation came through Israel, and it's Israel that must welcome him back. So the Jewish remnant in the room here and the grafted in branch now living in Israel these many, many years, we appeal to you. And I owe my life to Gentile believers who prayed for me and witnessed to me, shared the gospel. Here, Orit shares her testimony, the same thing. We as Jews are indebted to Gentile believers, and Gentile believers are indebted to Jews like Yeshua and Paul and others. So pray for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Again, the website for Michael and Orit Murnane, iblessjerusalem.com, iblessjerusalem.com. If you want to email them with questions, get their newsletter to find out how to pray for Israel or invite them to minister at your church this year or next. You can email them at cometozion@aol.com. And remember the resource we're making available all this week, one that we've gotten a great response to and I think will really edify you. Over 20 hours of my best teaching on how to be led by the Spirit, how to know the voice of God, how to walk with the Lord, how to live a holy life, overcome sin, walk in grace. At half price, plus we're paying the postage, how to be led by the Spirit, living a holy life. Give us a call at 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. That's also the number to call if you'd like to become a monthly torchbearer or make a one-time contribution to help us reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line, if you want to see the faithfulness of God, if you want to see that God keeps his promises, look at Israel. Look at the Jewish people. He said my people would be scattered. He said that we would be regathered. He said that we would be disciplined, but that we would be preserved as a people. And he said once we were brought back into the land, he would sprinkle clean water upon us. And day by day, more and more Israelis are coming to faith in Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. Our God is faithful. Our God is true. What a surprise. I've got some friends from Israel that happen to be passing through. We've pulled them into the studio. We're going to go from the Holocaust to the land of Israel to teen life in Israel today. Stay tuned.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it was just a couple days ago, I got an email from a dear friend, Michael Murnane. He and his wife, Orit, and their six kids live in Israel. They're in the States for a little while. We did an Israel conference together in Connecticut that some of you actually may have attended. And he said they're passing through. They might be able to swing by Thursday, join me on the radio. I said, are you kidding? Let's see if we can work it out. So last night, just late last night, we confirmed we could do it. We had a great first hour with Michael and Orit. You can listen to it on our website, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. Later today, you'll be able to listen to it. And I'm not going to repeat all of that because there's so much more we want to talk about. But we have added to the mix, after talking to Michael and Orit, we have added Oria, who's 14 years old and is going to tell us some stories about life in Israel, excuse me, as a teenager that will be quite eye-opening. I'm not going to take a lot of calls, but I might take some. So if you'd like to ask our guests a question, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Okay, before we get to our 14-year-old guest, a very mature 14-year-old, and by the way, you got to mature a bit more quickly in Israel. Just That's life right. Life requires it. We'll talk about that in a moment and talk about even some of Orion's friends very close to a recent a terrorist attack in Israel. But Orit, before we do that, let's give our listeners an understanding of what God's been doing in the land of Israel. Your grandparents miraculously survived the Holocaust. Your mother was a baby in a bassinet when the Nazis came, grabbed your dad. They didn't see the baby behind the door. He endured torture, deprivation, miraculously survived the Holocaust. Your grandmother in another home with your mom, were 4 years basically solitary confinement in a basement, no sunlight, no heat, only out once outside in 4 years. They survived the Holocaust. They ultimately make it to the land of Israel. They're not believers. Orit, you come to faith at the age of 17. How many other 17-year-old, what year was that, Orit?
That was 81.
81,
so
okay.
You can figure out the math of how old I am. So.
All right, but we weren't even thinking that. We weren't. Okay, 1981. How many other 17-year-old or teenage Messianic Jews were there? Or let's say native-born Israeli teenage believers. How many did you know in 1981?
I think I was the only one, and I just want to give just this one thing that in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, the Lord have hovered. The Holy Spirit have hovered in a very special way over Israel, the land of Israel, where a handful, not more than 12 Israelis came to the Lord. Now, these were Israelis who were born Sabras in the land.
Sabra is a native-born Israeli.
Israelis who did not come from a Messianic background, didn't have Messianic family, didn't have, like, how you would say, a Christian grandma to pray them into the kingdom. Mm. They came to the Lord totally by a revelation of the Lord, by the supernatural, where we had one friend who would sit in the kitchen, and Jesus appeared on a cross before him in the kitchen in a live vision.
And this is so foreign for an Israeli. Completely
this is
foreign.
Scary for Israeli, right? Because they suddenly realize who is the Messiah that they have never expected. We have a history teacher, a history professor at the university who always taught against Jesus, and suddenly Yeshua sits by his side on the sofa, and he was completely undone to realize that the one that he had hated all these years was the real Messiah. People would hear the Lord Yeshua call them audibly, speak to them audibly. They would see the name of Yeshua written in the sky, totally by the supernatural. The supernatural. That's how the Lord reached the first Messianic believers in Israel, 12
wow.
of them.
So a sovereign working of God. Hey, friends, God is faithful. God is true. We're going to catch up to 21st century Israel when we come back. Stay with us.
Change the world. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's Thursday, which means we're focused on Israel and the Jewish people, and we have brought Israel into the studio with us today, a wonderful family, the Murnane family. If you want to go to the website for the ministry work they do, go to iblessjerusalem.com. If you've got a question for our guest, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire to weigh in there, or call us at 866-34-TRUTH. But again, just to warn you up front, when I do interviews, and I've got folks in the studio with me in particular, I'll take some questions, but I take up as much time as I can because I've got a ton of questions I want to ask. So, Orit, before we get to your daughter, Oria, and Michael is a proud dad sitting by smiling rather than I talk to his wife and his daughter. He's a humble servant of the Lord. Okay, Orit, you get saved. You hardly know anybody else your age, native-born Israeli, who's been saved. I remember our friends, Shani and Ayal Sarkaram, when they grew up in Israel, the two of them were the only believers that they knew. And they used to joke and say, what's the Messianic youth group in Israel going to do today? Because they were it.
That's right.
What was life like? You were telling me during the break that you went through some degree of persecution and hardship, the first believers that were there in those years to get to where you are today.
Right. We were about 12, 13 people, the most Israeli-born, Sabras, born in the land. And I was the youngest of all. I was 17. The rest were like in their early, mid-20s. That was about it. And so when you become a believer, you immediately lose all your friends. Immediately, when you share with your friends, when you finally master the courage, because it was absolutely unacceptable to be a Messianic believer, that then to say that you believe in Yeshua was unacceptable completely. So if you already mastered the courage to say something, you would lose your friends right away. Not only that, I've had friends that their parents said 7 days of mourning. It's called Shiva in the Jewish tradition, that when somebody dies in the Jewish family, the family sits 7 days of mourning, sit on the floor, tear up their clothes, wear black clothes. And every Jewish family does this till this very day all over the world. So they will sit 7 days of mourning over their son or daughter. And they would say, I'd rather you be a prostitute or a drug addict or a homeless person or a useless person rather than that you should believe in that man. They would not even utter the name of Yeshua on their lips.
So that would still be the case with a religious Jewish family today. But you're saying even the Israelis then that weren't that religious, just because of everything they had come through, the Holocaust and their view of Christianity, that they would sit shiver, they would mourn. And better to be a drug addict than to believe in that man. Wouldn't even say his name.
That's right. That's right. You would lose your job. You could, your property can be vandalized. You can be called names. Everything. You'll be harassed big time. So we have had to endure a lot. That means that once you make a conscious decision that, and you know that is the truth, that Yeshua is the Messiah, you cannot go back, and you know that there is a price, and you have to be willing to pay the price, and the price is high. So you know that you have given everything up, you know, in order to believe in Yeshua, and there are consequences for that. But the Lord have honored the time of persecution and the hardship that we had to go through. First of all, we had to dig our roots deep in the ground. There's no place for compliance, and like sort of like sitting on the fence, like a lot of youth in America do today. They sit on the fence. They're lukewarm. They're not here. They're not there, and they compromise. You could not compromise and sit on the fence because there was no place for that. Mm. There's no place because of what you had to endure.
There was no fence. You're either in or out.
No, either here or there. If you were in any given time lukewarm, you would fall back to the world. So the Lord have honored that time, that what we had to go through. And today, we are today's leaders in the Messianic body of Messiah. We're all pastors' wives, heads of ministries. That is the foundation. This is how the Lord started the Messianic movement from scratch.
And then what happened, let's say from early 2000s, what began to happen in Israel?
Okay, from the early 80s all the way to 2000, there were hardly any believers coming to the Lord, basically because of persecution and our intimidation to share Yeshua. So if there will be one believer coming to the Lord a year, I'm not exaggerating, one would come to the Lord a year.
So you're talking about native-born Israelis?
Yes, we would be rejoicing and saying, there is one believer over there and over here. And we will know everything about that person, you know, every detail about that person. And that's how we went on for 20 years. But in the year around the year 2000, it started to escalate, where suddenly more people started to come to the Lord, and suddenly the doors opened, and young Israelis started to come to the Lord. Now, what have happened? You know, it's basically a new generation. It's not my generation and the Holocaust generation of my parents and my grandparents who were so fearful and rejecting the message of Messiah. It's a new generation that have basically rejected the Orthodox ways, the rabbinical Orthodox ways, are fed up with the religious spirit of the Orthodox, but still are looking for some spiritual form, because once you reject God or form of religious Judaism, you sort of create a hole. There is a hole in your heart that still longs for God's presence, and so you have to fill that hole. And so a lot of Israeli people started to turn into New Age, because yeah. They're open, and started to go to India, to all kinds of places, to look for Shanti.
I had a friend who was in, I believe, Nepal, and while the place he found, they had menus in Hebrew at the restaurant,
yes.
Because there's so many Israelis that
right.
were there. So God's been moving on the new generation. Let's talk to some of this new generation. Oriah, get a little closer to the mic there, honey. How old are you?
I'm 14.
14 years old. Okay. You go to a Messianic Jewish school?
Yeah, I go to a Messianic school in Jerusalem. It's basically the only one in the country.
Really? And you have to live with the reality of terrorism, of attack and threat. So do you have like preparations or drills that you go through in the school?
Yeah, in certain, not certain schools, in all schools, once a year or even twice a year, we have a drill. That we have an alarm, and everybody lines up and goes to everybody goes to the safe place,
the like, bomb shelter.
Yeah, the bomb shelter.
So you have to know where this. That's just normal life, because an attack may happen. Now, some of your friends were actually close to a terrorist attack recently. What happened?
Yeah, there was a terrorist attack in Jerusalem in the central bus station, and a few of my friends were at the bus. It happened in there was a backpack or something next to a telephone booth, mm-hmm. and two buses were really close to it, and five of my friends were on that bus, and I heard a lot of stories that they were terrified and afraid and just wanted to get out of the bus.
So did the bomb actually go off, or there was just concern that it was going to go off?
No, it did go off. A lot of people were scared, and everything was shaking. That's what I heard from my friends.
Mm.
And they just escaped and ran away.
Wow. So this is not, though, that unusual. In other words, this is part of life that you've grown up with in Israel?
Yeah, that's part of life. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but sometimes we do hear that there was an attempt of suicide or something happened.
Suicide bomber, yeah.
Yeah.
And what happens when you get to be 17, 18 years old? What do you have to do?
We all go to the army. It's
But you're a girl.
Yeah, still.
Male and female. And, mm-hmm. and Ori, you were in the army?
I was in the Navy, right.
In the Navy. Okay, so everyone's going to go. You're a young lady, but you know when you get to that age, there could be a possible delay if you're out of the country or something. But otherwise, 17, 18 years old, you go into the army. How long do you have to serve?
Girls do 2 years, and boys and guys do 3 years.
Okay, and do you have older brothers and sisters?
Yeah, my brother is right now in the army, and my older sister just got out of the army 3 years ago.
And that's because you Israelis, you love to go to war, you love to fight, you love to go in the army. Is that it, or you have no choice?
It's basically both, but I'm really happy to serve my country, and everybody loves to serve their country. It's not like we're forced to. It's not like, oh, man, I have to go to the army. We're happy to serve our country and to defend ourselves and the people.
But it's a matter of, it's not like you love to fight. It's self-defense.
Yeah.
So you understand that. So when just you're a teenage girl, you go to the mall. Do you have security in the mall? What mm-hmm. happens when you go to the mall?
When we go to the mall, we have a guard that checks everybody. There's no such thing that you would go to a mall and nobody will check your backpack or your purse, whatever you have.
This is everybody, just shopping. And then what about, Do you see soldiers around a lot? If you sit down at a cafe somewhere, there are kind of soldiers everywhere?
Yeah, there are soldiers a lot. I'm very proud to see them. And basically, everybody's really happy to serve their country. Everybody's really proud of it. And I'm also proud to see a young Israeli defending our country, and to see my brother coming home every 2 weeks.
And if you got to the point where people weren't trying to kill you, and you didn't have to defend yourselves, would that be a good day?
I don't know.
hard to imagine.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine is really what that answer meant. All right, we're going to talk more, friends. Some interesting questions to ask. Stay with us.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I find it so interesting. You get different perspectives, older generation, younger generation, American, Israeli, just whatever culture background you come from, man, woman, different perspectives. I find it so interesting that I've talked to parents moved from America to Israel. Now they have to send their kids into war. And they've said, hey, look, we don't love sending our kids into war. You know, our daughters or our sons, we're not eager to send them to the battlefield. And many of them are in combat positions and life-threatening positions. We don't love having to do that. We'd much rather a situation where we didn't have to. I asked an Israeli teenager. She wants to emphasize she's proud to be able to defend her country. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire. Thursdays, we always focus on Israel-Jewish-related subjects, so I'm delighted to have an Israeli family, dear friends of mine. In fact, Oria, who's 14, when I first knew your mom and dad, you didn't exist. You didn't exist. So great to see the family growing. Michael and Orit Murnane in the States for a little while. They normally come every summer and do some ministry here. So, Oria, you've been in the States a good amount of time. You've seen American teenagers. And I'm not asking, like, who's better or who's worse. Obviously, you're an Israeli first. But what kind of differences do you see between Israeli teenagers and American teenagers?
A few of the differences I see between Israelis and American teenagers are maturity.
All right, how so?
Israelis will be a little bit more mature and, like, They'll know how to express themselves sometimes better or more mature. I don't know how to explain it.
Okay, it's but you've noticed it. Okay, why? And by the way, I appreciate you speaking to us in English as opposed to Hebrew, which is your first language. But and just get a little closer to the mic for me, thanks. Why is it, from your point of view, that an Israeli teenager is forced to mature more quickly than maybe an American teenager?
Well, we're not forced to mature. We want to mature. It's part of life. You need to mature when you hit teenagers' years. So you need to mature. It's like it happens. You need to go to the army. You need to serve your country and to be proud of it.
So the fact that by the time you're 17, 18, you're going to be in the army, that gives a little different perspective on life, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Let's add to this the fact that you are a follower of Yeshua. So God's moving. There are more and more young people coming to faith. You can be at a conference, and there are hundreds of young people who love Yeshua at this conference together. And you're in a Messianic Jewish school.
Yeah.
But still, it's a very small number.
Exactly.
So what does this add to your life? And you also, you want to live a holy life. You're not going to do drugs or get drunk or do those kinds of things. So you're living a different life than some of the other teenagers. So how does that work out?
Well, first of all, I'm very, very happy to see that there are a lot of teenagers my age believe in Yeshua, that I can be friends of them and not worry that they will smoke or take drugs or drink a lot. And it's just really, really good to have Messianic friends.
Yeah, that is, as opposed to when your mom got saved at 17, she was the only one that she knew that it was
not
her
too
age.
Many, yeah, to compare to, yeah.
Right, so that's one generation, and God's done amazing things. But in the world in general, Israeli kids that don't know Yeshua, a lot of them are worldly, right? They're not all holy kids.
No, they're not.
and what about the army? Is the army like a holy atmosphere?
No, not at all. I don't think so.
Yeah, and you know, her again, if you just tuned in, she's had siblings that have served in the army or are currently serving in the Israeli army. So in other words, the Israeli society is a worldly society. Say going to Tel Aviv, is that like a really holy city?
No, not really. I don't really like being in Tel Aviv actually at all.
How come?
I just don't like the atmosphere. I really like Jerusalem much better.
So maybe more believers or more spiritual focused. Ari, what's Tel Aviv like?
Well, I grew up in Tel Aviv, and I really liked Tel Aviv when I grew up, but I would not raise my children, and I have a family in Tel Aviv of today, because it's mostly, most Tel Aviv, more than 50% are single people or living together and not being married. And it's just very, very worldly, nightlife, just like a very worldly city.
All right, so let's just paint a picture. You've got the very, very, very religious, the ultra-Orthodox, very, very devoted. Some would find them hypocritical. In certain ways, most of the society doesn't like them. And then the rest of the society, the bulk of the people, 75, 80, 85%, whatever it is,
are secular.
Secular.
Right.
So what does that mean?
Okay, most people who had not been to Israel think that all of Israel is ultra-Orthodox, like the ones that you see in New York with the black hats and the curls and the black outfits, but not so. Only 20% are ultra-Orthodox or Orthodox to some form and degree, and the rest are just like regular people, just like what you see in your own street, just regular secular Israeli people. They may be atheists, they may have a faith in God, but this is just secular Jewish people.
Got it. And so like the Sabbath for them, for your average Israeli.
Okay. Sabbath is kept in all of Israel. It might be different for you here because Sabbath here is just any other day, except that you don't go to work and you may go to the mall. In Israel, everything shuts down for Shabbat. We say Shabbat. Everything shuts down for Shabbat. You will have no stores to go shopping, no supermarkets. Maybe a few restaurants will be open just for entertainment. But people drive much less or visit just friends. Everybody makes sure that you take the day to rest and do recreational stuff and rest, but there is no work except like emergency, you know, like hospitals and places like that. But you truly feel the sense of Shabbat. People just stay home and make sure that they rest.
And in your own family, as Jewish followers of Yeshua, and I was at your house my last trip to Israel. What's Friday night like? Erev Shabbat, the night leading into Shabbat, the Sabbath.
Oh, that's the biggest. That's the best thing of Shabbat, that we gather together, all the family. We have 6 children, and they have their friends that they bring many times to our home, and we have friends. And so we end up being a large, large family with a few tables all across. And we just feast on food and have a great time of just being together as a family. And Shabbat meal, we start with lighting the candles and blessing the challah bread, drinking wine, passing it around. That's called Kiddush. And it's a part of almost every household, especially in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is very traditional.
All right, so even though you're Jewish followers of Yeshua, there's some traditions that you've kept, and then just the Sabbath command.
Right.
And Oriah, I noticed you smiling. You like the Sabbath meal. And
yeah, I really like it. It's very fun.
What's special about it?
It's special that it doesn't really happen in the world. It's something like... Well, it does, but it's something like special for Israel, and Jewish people do it. It's like very special. I really like it.
So it's family focused. Is it spiritual for you also?
Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, so this is something that takes place in Israel, and especially for the believers, it has special meaning. All right, we've got some phone questions and a whole lot more to talk to our guests about. Stay with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I had been thinking about where I was going to go on the broadcast today, questions we were going to entertain about Israel and the Jewish people, and got word from some dear friends from Israel that they were going to be passing through and they could work it out to get here in time for the radio show. I said, let's do it. We'll have the family on. So it's been my delight to be talking to Michal and Orit Murnane from Israel here in the States. For how long before you go back to Israel, Orit?
Another 3 weeks.
Okay. And also some younger kids here, but they speak Hebrew. And then Oriel, who's 14, thankfully speaks Hebrew and English. So we've got some interesting perspectives from Israel, some amazing stories about their background, their life. If you missed any of the program, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Line of Fire, and you can listen to the entire program later today. Also, if you have a question for our guest, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Before we take a question from one of our callers, Oria, 14 years old, Israel's your home, Hebrew's your first language, you have most of your friends there. Oh, you're in America, though. What do you like about America, and are you eager to get back home?
What I like about America is that there are more believers.
Uh-huh.
That you can share your faith more easily. Like, you know, oh, he's a believer too. But it's not that in Israel. You can also share your faith. And I also really like the shopping.
Ah, a little bit more shopping. And you don't get searched when you go into the mall. You don't have all your stuff inspected by security.
No, not really.
Do you have any more sense of safety in America than in Israel, or you just don't worry about that?
Actually, I don't really worry about that because I know God protects me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, I basically think it's more safe in Israel. Like, I feel more safe there walking in the street than walking in America here alone in the street. It's very different.
Why is that? It just seems more wild here, or there's less security here?
Yeah, I think so. I feel more safe in Israel because I know I'm just not afraid nothing's going to happen. I know nothing's going to happen if I walk down the street because there's like people around everywhere. You can walk dark at night in the parks and nothing will happen to you.
Because there's enough security to keep out outside terrorists, so that also gives you security within the land. All right, we got a personal family question. Steve in Kaysville, Utah, thanks for calling the Line of Fire today.
Yes, sir, Dr. Brown, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for your guest and your courage. I missed the first part of the show, and you may have talked about it already, but I wanted to find out if your guest was married, if her husband was a Christian prior to them getting married, and kind of how that transpired.
Sure thing. So Orit, how did you and Michal meet? And Michal was a Gentile, Catholic raised in Boston, came to saving faith in Yeshua, and this is in the late 70s. He wanted to find out more about biblical Hebrew roots of the faith, and God called him to live in Israel. So how did the two of you meet and come together?
Well, when my husband was living in Israel in the 80s, he was already a believer in Yeshua. He was born again, and I just came back from Bible school in England, and we met. I was walking with the Lord, he was walking with the Lord, and within 6 months we were married because we knew that it was with the Lord. So we were both walking with the Lord when we got married and when we met.
All right, and hey, just out of curiosity, we only got 30 seconds, but you had three older kids, then three younger kids. Was that the plan?
No. If you would have asked me, when I first married, that if you would have told me that I have six kids, I would have thought that I have become an Orthodox Jew or something, you know? No, that was not the plan. We had three kids, and then the Lord gave us three more kids after 6 years of no kids, of space in between.
All right, so maybe three more after the...
That's it.
Okay, all right.
It's a done deal.
We'll be back, friends.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I want to mention again that when I've got guests in the studio, sometimes we've got guests with us, and I love for you to call in and ask them a million questions. In fact, going to have a guest on, God willing, next week, who's one of the top scholars as a young earth creationist. And I'd love for all of you who have questions to call him. But other times when I have guests, I kind of hog the program. I know we're Jews, so we don't hog things, but it's figure of speech. Because of all the questions I want to ask. However, if you'd like to ask Michal Orit or even Oria a question about Israel, life in Israel, or what the Lord is doing, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, Michael Brown, with my guests, Michal and Orit Murnane and their family. Okay, Oria, before we turn things over to your dad, as a 14-year-old Israeli believer, you wanted to give a word of encouragement and exhortation to other young people who are listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it is very important to walk with the Lord and to go to congregation, and also encourage friends to walk with the Lord too, and just share faith with who doesn't believe.
And what about how important is it for you to be in the Word of God and meeting with the Lord daily in prayer? How important is that in your own life?
Oh, it is very important. Sometimes if I don't do that, I feel something is missing. Something isn't there. So immediately I pray and open my Bible and Scripture.
And are you aware, even at this age, of a lot of pressure coming against you from the society, from the world, and pulling on you?
Yeah, I do. There's a lot of fear pressure. If you go to a regular public school, you'll have a lot of fear pressure probably. And it's just things you have to deal with. And if you're strong enough with the Lord and walk with Him, so they shouldn't be a problem.
Got it. So you got to put your roots down deep.
Yeah.
And then when the attack comes, you stand strong. And there is a lot of pressure, just life in Israel in general. In fact, we've got another question. We need you to stay right here before we turn things over. I'm not sure who the question's for, just because they're having a hard time spelling the Hebrew names. But you're doing a great job. Just talk to our phone guys. You're doing a great job trying to sort out the Hebrew here. But Orit, I know as an Israeli, you're used to life in Israel. And we're hearing from Oria, used to life in Israel. Mm-hmm. But you also know what life is like in America and other countries. Right. There's a lot more pressure in daily life.
Right.
Give us a picture of that, the pressure of daily life in Israel.
We experience pressure from different directions. First of all, it's our military. It's our security with other nations. What's going on within the land, from the Palestinian Authority, from the Gaza region. It affects us. Most of us and our children. We have children in the army. All of our friends, you know. So we experience it firsthand when our children are watching over the borders and doing all kinds of military actions. So we experience, first of all, in the military security level, then economically, because wages in Israel are very low. Our economy isn't as easy as here. For instance,
how about taxes on a vehicle?
Taxes are about 120% on a vehicle. We pay over 50% income tax on our income, and about 16 or 17% sales tax. And everything for us costs 2 to 3 times more than what it will cost for you. Just the simple things in Walmart and so on will cost 2 to 3 times more for us.
What about the price of gas?
The price of, okay, we pay over $8 a gallon in Israel.
Got it.
And
you're not making as much money.
And we don't make much money at all. So all this pressure, it's all added pressure. So when you walk in Israel, you don't see people are joyful and happy and say, hi, how you doing to you in the street and smiling to you, or even opening the door for you in the mall. They kind of let the door go in your face, so to speak.
Right. It's not the most welcoming friend. You got to be tough.
Yeah.
What does the word sabra mean?
Okay. Sabra, it's coming from the word sabal. Sabal is the fruit of the cactus, that if you look at the fruit of the cactus, it has thorns on the outside. to peel it, you have to use like builder's gloves to peel it with a knife, and inside there is a sweet fruit.
So this is the name that's given to a native-born Israeli.
Because we are very thorny on the outside, but inside we are sweet, and so you really need to reach our heart, to reach the inside of us to find out that we are really nice people, but just life makes us very hard on the outside.
And like traffic and...
Traffic is very crazy, right? But we're not very polite, right. But we are very hospitable and warm people.
Right, very social.
Very social.
Right. And just one other thing about life pressure. You talk about the taxes and all of this. Now, I'm sure there's stuff the government does well and stuff where the government's inefficient. And, some of you are going to have those problems and things could function better. But does a lot of the money go to the military?
Yes, I think if I'm correct, it's about 70% of the budget goes to security. We got one of the strongest military in the world, I think, outside of America, just because America has the technology and has the money behind it.
Right, and the size, the numbers. Right. Yeah, whatever the number is, I don't know how high it is, but things would be a lot cheaper if you weren't surrounded by potential enemies and threats
on
every side.
That's right.
Let me ask you this one question, and then... Lori from Portland, hang in there. I want to get to your question. Obviously, there's hostility both ways. You've got almost 1.5 million Arab Israelis living in the land, but they're full citizens. They're in the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, and they're functioning normally. But then you have those that would identify as Palestinians. And obviously, there's been a generation that's grown up side by side, and there's been hostility. You're an Israeli believer, but your average Israeli... do you think that they would accept a two-state solution if they were sure that there'd be peace?
You know what? It's a hard question, but a lot of Israelis are now, their heart is towards that because they, have compromised the promises of God of who the land belongs to, which I firmly believe it belongs to Israel with all the four borders that are that we're giving back to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of Israeli people are so tired of wars. We basically, since the establishment of the State of Israel in 48, we have had 10 wars. Every 10 years there's a war. So we've had already 6 major wars, and people right and left have lost family members, fathers, children, sons, and
so
on.
And then the intifadas, the terrorist attacks and all of that.
Right, so they're so tired of it that they're just willing to do anything just to have peace now.
Got it. All right, Lori in Portland, Oregon, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. I would have 1 million questions for the whole family, but I'm going to just focus on Oriel. Am I saying it right?
Oria, the daughter?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, the mother is Orit and the daughter is Oria. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, it's funny that you brought up Palestinian questions because my question for Oriel is, do you get to see very many Palestinian kids? Are you able to be friends with them? Do you want to be friends with them? And how do they differ from Israeli kids?
All right, did you understand the question?
Half of it.
Okay, so I'll repeat it then. Do you get to see or meet Palestinian kids? Is it possible to be friends with them? Is there any interaction between you and Palestinian kids?
Actually, not really. We don't live in the same area. We do live in the same area, but we're not really mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't meet any Palestinians and became friends with them yet. But I think it's a really good way to make new friends and also see that it's not enemy.
Like, so you'd be open to that. You'd be open to that possibility.
Yeah, I'll be open for it. But I think it's a good way.
Okay. And have you ever been at like a youth gathering where some Palestinian kids came in as well? I know they've done that in previous years. Were you ever part of that?
No, I wasn't part of it. But my older sister Oriel was, and she really liked it.
Wonderful. So, I mean, the spirit of reconciliation, especially among the believers, is there. Anything you'd like to add, Orit?
Well, we live in two separate areas. Many times the Palestinian kids, teenagers, or adults cannot cross over to our areas and vice versa. We're not allowed to go to their areas. So it's not like we're side by side everywhere and we can just become friends. It's just not possible in that way. you know. And we have our differences, too, that we have to work on.
Right.
You know, we always are, like, suspicious of each other. Like, what's your reaction towards me? And so on. And sometimes there's replacement theology that we find along the way that a lot of the Palestinian, even Christians, hold. And that is hard for us, that they don't accept us. They don't accept the fact that God gave Israel to the Jewish people. And so it's very hard to talk on those terms. You know, it's only the love of Jesus that can surpass and overcome those differences.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I always hear from the hearts of the believers in the land, Jewish believers, Gentile believers. All right, we'll be back with some perspective of what God is doing and what the church needs to be doing in terms of the land of Israel.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We have shifted seats and mics. We've got Michael back in with us, Michael Murnane, the patriarch of the family here. And what's funny is here he grows up as a Boston Gentile, but of course living in Israel becomes totally fluent in Hebrew. And I speak some modern Hebrew, but my fluency is in biblical Hebrew. So over the years, whenever we'd hang out, he was always working on my modern Hebrew. I remember we'd play ping pong, and we had to do all the counting of numbers and playing in Hebrew. All right, we just got a few minutes left. If you just tuned in, you've missed some great stories from Israel, some great history. So go to the website, askdrbrown.org, click on the Line of Fire later today, and listen to the entire interview with Michael and Orit Murnane and their daughter, Oriel, that we brought on as well. And go to iblessjerusalem.com to find out about what the Murnanes are doing. iblessjerusalem.com. They may even have the opportunity to come and visit your congregation before they leave America, or certainly to plan to come and minister for you in a future trip. So we will talk about something very important but very controversial, okay? You have TV shows on Christian television, say a man like Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein, and Christians give tens of millions of dollars to this work, which they think is a ministry. Now, he doesn't claim, right. He doesn't get up and say, I'm a follower of Yeshua. He doesn't lie about that. He's an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. But the whole appeal is to help get Jewish people back in the land. And I'm sure they're doing things like that. Everyone cares about that, and the elderly and the hurting and so on. But Christians give tens of millions of dollars every year to this organization. And they think, from what I've been told, surveys, most of them think they're giving it to Jewish evangelism. Then you have other organizations, major Christian organizations, that are definitely Christian and followers of Jesus, and they unite together to stand with Israel, and they raise tons of money, and then they give that money to the land. Michael, where does a lot of that money go, and how do you, as Jewish believers in Israel, without a lot of money, I mean, almost all the Jewish believers in Israel have, they're still pioneering, it's still challenging, they could really use money. Where does this money go that these Christians are giving tens of millions of dollars to Israel? Yes. Where does it go, and how do you feel about it?
Most of it goes, Dr. Brown, to the Orthodox community for their schools, their support systems, and yeshivas. And ultimately, it gets filtered down, and even as one of these men said, that they stand against the Messianic community. And much, and some of that money is even used to come against the Messianic community in Israel. So it's
going to Orthodox Jews, and we love and pray for it. I've got dear Orthodox Jewish friends I talk to, interact with all the time. But they are training their kids to believe in traditional Judaism and decidedly not to believe in Yeshua.
Not to look at Yeshua and believe in that. And it
and to oppose the Messianic movement.
And oppose the Messianic movement.
Look, here is a fact, okay? Most of our congregations, we have about 120 congregations across the nation. Most of the congregations, 99, 95% of them rent their own facility. None of us have the finances to buy a building, okay? If only half of this money would go to legitimate
Messianic... How about a tenth of it? I mean, it'd be great if all of it, but if a tenth of it.
that would be, we will be able to buy our own facilities. You know, we don't have a facility of our own. We have to rent. That's only if the landlord is willing to rent to the Messianic Jews. Mostly, it's a hard battle even to find a building that somebody is willing to rent to you because you're a Messianic Jew, and the owner knows that not long before that the Orthodox would come and start to vandalize his building because he's renting to us. Mm-hmm. If the money would go to the Messianic Jews, to evangelical bodies, to the body of Messiah, we would be able to have our own congregations.
So, and then it makes it more legitimate in the eyes of the society.
Yes,
too.
You know, yes. Paul said, you know, he collected the offerings for the saints of Jerusalem. He did not collect it for the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which is today's modern Orthodox Jews. And I look at it the same. I'm a firm believer that the money of well-meaning Christians who love Israel needs to go to the body of Messiah to build the kingdom in Israel, to build his kingdom in Israel,
yes.
Not to build the state of Israel.
Yes.
Now, I heard approximately $70 million was raised from my Christian brothers in here in wonderful churches in the States and given to the Orthodox community. If we had $70 million, we could have literally bought, we've done a plan, we could have bought a congregational building for probably every congregation in the land and put the pastor on salary for a year. That's uncomprehendable.
And just the amount of outreach that could be done.
Yes.
Look, when folks give money to our ministry here, to what we're doing to Ask Dr. Brown and Designated for Jewish Ministry, well, we're doing Jewish ministry constantly, trying to reach Jewish people.
Yes.
When people say, I want to give to Israel, I say, you need to give to Jewish believers in Israel. So please hear me, friends. We're not even telling you to give extra money. We're telling you to take the money that you're giving to other organizations for Israel and to give it instead to Jewish believers, the Israel within Israel. Give it to Jewish believers in Israel doing the work. One of the ministries you can support. I know their integrity. I know how they live. iblessjerusalem.com. Or if you want to email them, come to Zion, Zion, come to Zion at AOL.com. Hey, we've just got a minute. If you could say something to the church in America, what would you say?
I would say, in the same line that we're talking about, not to just build up Israel naturally and give it to the Orthodox community and the unbelieving community, but build up the Messianic community, build up Israel spiritually, because the Lord wants to open the eyes of the Jewish people there, and the church is the tool to equip that. So I encourage the Christians out there to build up Israel spiritually and give to Messianic ministries. Like Online Fire, that I encourage you, that all the work you're doing. Maybe people, Christians here, maybe to consider giving to Dr. Michael Brown with all the work he's doing here. He's helping get the word out that the Messianic community needs the help.
And if you want to designate when you give to us, I was trying to get it to you, by the way. But come on. You showed some Gentile blood there. The Jewish
blood, give
it to our ministry. Right. Send it our way. And again, friends, we're in this together. We absolutely need one another. And none of us are going to do it on alone. The Jewish people need the prayers of the church. The Jewish people need the witness of the church. The Jewish people need the support of the church. And just as it was the door open from Jews to Gentiles, the Gentiles opened the door to Jews to come back. Hey, we're out of time. Orit, Michal, thank you so much. Oria on the other side of the studio, thanks for being with us. Friends, remember our resource offer this week. It's really one of the most practical, helpful. We've put together two CDs, over 20 hours of teaching for your computer MP3 player on how to be led by the Spirit, how to really hear the voice of God, how to understand His will and walk with Him, and how to live a holy life, how to overcome sin, how to live without condemnation. Over 20 hours of teaching, just $20, we pay the postage. So it's a great discount, great resource. Call us at 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. If you'd like to stand with us, that's the place to call as well. And again, the website for our friends, the Murnanes, iblessjerusalem.com. My bottom line, yes, the Word of God declares that all Israel will be saved. Yes, the Word of God declares that at that time, God will be the God of all the families of Israel. But it will not just happen on its own. It will happen in answer to the prayers of God's people. It will happen in answer to the intercession of the church. Pray for the salvation of the Jewish people.